What do you say to people who say, Dr. Kevorkian, you are playing God?
Well, so is a doctor who takes your heart from one body and puts it in another, isn't he? A doctor always plays God, even when he gives you a pill, because he's interfering with a natural process.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Rachel here, your resident empath, and it shouldn't come as a shock at this point, but this case made me extremely emotional. I don't know why I wasn't expecting it, because I don't think there'd be a human on this planet that wouldn't become emotional over this subject, and you'll hear why very soon. So let's jump in. And as always, thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care when listening to this episode. It is a rough one, but we're going to get through it together. So this is the case of Dr. Jack Kevorkian and doctor-assisted suicide. But it is so much more than that. This is about the complicated nature of humans, ethics, religion, and one man's, albeit haphazard, attempt to create change in the medical field. He was a complicated man, but all humans are. I mean, I'll never know all there is to know about my best friends, probably. And they'll never know all there is to know about me. I mean, only one person, okay, shit, now all of you are gonna know this. Well, here we go with my big mouth. That I couldn't resist eating the king crab legs I got from Costco on sale a couple weeks ago in my mother's car, who kind of has OCD. She's a neat freak, and she would probably disown me if she knew that. But they were just sitting next to me in the passenger seat, and I was like, they said they're fully cooked, and I'm hungry. It's like, looks like a good snack. I could just crack them open while driving. So I got to a stop sign, and I did, and I enjoyed at least one full crab leg before I began to feel so much shame that I covert pulled over into a gas station, pretending to get gas, because I thought that someone like spotted me on the road like eating crab legs. I was like, someone's going to arrest me. There's something wrong with me. So I pulled over into a gas station, pretended to get gas while I like secretly like put like a sweatshirt over the crab legs in order to throw them away. I think some guy did see me throw them away. What's more disappointing is I wasted at least $8 worth of delicious crab legs, but I was in such a shame spiral at that point that I had to get rid of the contraband. And yeah, but this isn't about me. But there you go. See, I would guess that most people wouldn't think that that is something I would do. Well, maybe they would. Who knows? Seriously, though, it's possible you'll never fully know your own parents, your husband, wife, girlfriend, sister, your kids even. And that's okay, because we are all complicated, often polarizing as well. So the best thing we can do is approach everyone we meet with kindness and an open mind, as you never know what life has thrown at them. But more importantly than giving everyone else the compassion humans deserve, for Christ's sake, have some goddamn compassion for yourself, because we are always the hardest on ourselves. And one last quick anecdote before we get into the mind of Jack Kevorkian is the thing that kind of made me think, like, tragically flawed humans are the most interesting. So when I went to UCLA grad school for screenwriting, or it was a grad program, I got a certificate. I'm not trying to brag, because it wasn't like a full thing. But on the first day of class, the professor had us all write down on a piece of paper privately to ourselves the 5 worst things we've ever done in our life, okay? And then when we were done, he said, would anyone be brave enough to stand up and tell the class what it is that you wrote down? And I would say maybe like 10 people did. And after each person read their, you know, biggest sins, he said, do you hate that person? We were like, no. He said, that's a good character in a story. Granted, Jack Kevorkian is a character in real life, but it just goes to show you that we are all tragically flawed. So I'm going to give you my opinion up top. I'm not ascribing a seven deadly sin to him because I think he was a bit of a hero. A pioneer at the very least. And even if he was sometimes awkward as fuck in his delivery and his compassion and emotions, they were not really wrapped up in a pretty bow, but he showed them more in like a hesitant pat on the back, a phone call in the middle of the night, or really just letting you into his world just a bit, because his inner circle was very small, and very few people really knew Jack. But the ones that did, that must have been a hell of a ride.
Hugh, it's one of the most compelling issues of our time. If patients want to die, should doctors be allowed to help them die? According to the latest national survey, most Americans feel it should be a matter of personal choice, and it's believed that many doctors do help patients die. But only Dr. Kevorkian has created a suicide machine. This is the man, and this is his story.
Tense for me. I was very nervous, uneasy. Nobody can feel good under such circumstances. Nobody there felt good at all. By the way, strangely, except the patients. They were the only calm ones there. Everybody else was nervous, edgy, and tense. I'm here to serve the patient. A doctor is a servant. I serve the patient's need.
Why not wait until the state changes?
I didn't break any law. I didn't make that device to have a gimmick or to be different. I made that device because in Michigan, where there is no law against assisting a suicide, is the only way I can do it. I can assist the suicide in the most humane way possible.
It's a great honor for me to have played such an extraordinary, portrayed such an extraordinary person as Jack Kevorkian, you know.
Think about it. What if you didn't have to endure the agonies of Alzheimer's anymore, or ALS, or any other rare, incurable illness? What if there was a caring way to end your life with dignity, with the help of a trusted doctor, if that is what you chose to do, on your own terms? His critics were, and still are, as impassioned as his supporters, but both sides can find common ground on this one thing. Jack Kevorkian helped spur the growth of hospice care in the United States and helped educate doctors on end-of-life care, allowing them to become more sympathetic to those in severe pain in their final days, and more willing to prescribe medications to help relieve it. So to understand the man, you have to know a bit of his past. Jack Kevorkian was actually born Murad Kevorkian on May 26, 1928, to Armenian immigrant parents in Pontiac, Michigan. His parents had escaped the Armenian genocide. They were smuggled out of Turkey by missionaries in 1912. And that is something that always stuck with Jack. Whether he knew it or not, generational trauma ran deep with him. Jack was the second of three children, and the family survived the repercussions of the Great Depression thanks to income from the family's excavating company. The Kevorkians lived a comfortable life while many of those around them suffered. His parents were strict and religious, bringing their children up in the Christian faith. Jack, who earned the nickname by American friends and teachers, had other ideas where religion was concerned, and had trouble reconciling various belief systems. While the family regularly attended church, Jack championed the idea of miracles and an all-knowing God. And he questioned what sort of loving God would allow human suffering. And he ruthlessly debated this idea of God's existence in Sunday school classes every week and continuously challenged his teachers before leaving church altogether at the age of 12 in a sort of existential crisis. But you have to think about it. It said that he had an IQ of close to 200. I mean, he's more of a thinker. He's a sciencey type guy. And this was the beginning of a life of questioning everything, rarely accepting others' ideas at face value. His argumentative nature in church carried over into his academic life. He frequently engaged his teachers with his academic prowess, but he would also humiliate them when they couldn't keep up with his debate skills. And this alienated Jack from his peers, which made him dive even harder into his studies. Classmates labeled him an eccentric bookworm, and the more he became an outcast, the more he distanced himself from any thought of a romantic relationship. He had one girlfriend, and only one girlfriend, his entire life, allegedly. In 1945, Jack graduated from Michigan's Pontiac High School with honors when he was just 17. Surprisingly, given what we know of him now, Jack began his college career in the College of Engineering, that's pretty random, at the University of Michigan, with the hopes of becoming a civil engineer. But those aspirations didn't last longer than a semester. He decided to focus on botany and biology instead, and quickly set his sights on going to medical school. His persistence and extra heavy class loads paid off, and he graduated in medicine at U of M in 1952, specializing in pathology shortly thereafter. Then in 1953, the Korean War came calling, and Jack served 15 months as an army medic in Korea, something that would shape his later ideas for experiments, before finishing his service in Colorado. He then began his residency at the University of Michigan, where he became fascinated with death. Okay, and this part's like a little weird, but I think that, I don't know, some people are just morbid. I'm not trying to defend him, but he just, I think he was extremely intelligent. I think he was possibly on the spectrum. I don't know if I'm allowed to diagnose that, but I think that he just would become fixated on things. So, hear me out. So, he became pretty fixated on death, and he made regular visits to patients that were terminally ill, and this is creepy, even photographed their eyes in an attempt to pinpoint their exact moment of death. He would literally tape them open. However, it did help researchers and coroners or whatever to pinpoint the exact time of death. So he was just doing research, I think. His theory was that doctors could use this information to distinguish death from fainting, shock, or coma in order to learn when resuscitation was useless. Fine. Yes, that is a little cold. I would assume that at least always try and resuscitate, but he was direct to the point. There was no time for nonsense in Kevorkian's world. In his own words, Dr. Kevorkian told reporters later that, quote, "Really? My number one reason was because it was interesting. And my second reason was because it was a taboo subject," end quote. I mean, at least he's honest. The man has blind confidence and zero fear, it seems, which will explain what happens next. So he began proposing to colleagues that prisoners on death row should be used in medical experiments, and part of his reasoning was that the ancient Greeks did this with the Egyptian criminals, and his colleagues were just not into it, though. They were like, I think this is too far. He was veering way too far off the mainstream for them and made them uncomfortable. But what is one man's trash is another man's treasure? Kind of. I don't really think that phrase goes there. But so while most of his colleagues were saying, like, you can't sit with us, Jack, you're weird, one man felt inspired by him. And that man was Neil Nicol, a man that would become a lifelong best friend and who assisted him in procuring the chemicals and medications needed to carry out the last waltz of Kevorkian's patients, and even occasionally volunteered his own body for an experiment or two. Hey, if that's how they like to party, I support it. Undeterred by his peers' disdain for his ideas, Kevorkian thought he was onto something with using the convicts to further his research. He reasoned that similar modern experiments could not only save valuable research dollars, but also provide a glimpse into the anatomy of the criminal mind. But he wanted to run it by the prisoners first. No, seriously, he actually walked into an Ohio prison to meet with death row inmates and just see how they felt about being experimented on. He argued that, quote, "Condemned convicts could provide a service to humanity before their execution by volunteering for, quote, painless medical experiments that would begin while they were conscious and they would end in fatality," end quote. He argued that death row inmates could be executed in a way to save their organs, which in turn would save lives. Dr. Kevorkian even spoke with Barbara Walters for 2020 about this vision. Here he explains this concept in the interview.
What interested you in this whole area?
Really, what led me into this was working with condemned criminals on death row who want to donate organs when they're executed, and it isn't allowed. It boggles my mind that society would not allow, and doctors wouldn't do it, to take organs from men who are going to be executed under anesthesia at the time for execution and use those to save five or six other people. This is how I got into this whole field.
Why can't they take the organs immediately after death?
Because some of them would, maybe kidneys if they're taken right there in the chamber, but others can't be used. They've got to be taken as they are today with brain-dead donors. You can artificially create a brain-dead state by putting the prisoner under anesthesia at the time set for execution, so his life is never shortened.
And then you execute them while they're under anesthesia?
Well, they'll die when you take the organs.
I see.
Yes.
He saw the potential procedures as a way for the condemned men to pay society back for the lives they took by giving not only their lives through their execution, but also giving something more and saving others' lives in the process. And he wasn't the only person to feel this way. Sure, some convicts scoffed at the idea of being experimented on, but some, including one notable inmate, who responded to Kevorkian's plan stating that, quote, "It would help me think that I didn't succeed in making a total mess of my life. That I may have helped someone, somewhere, sometime," end quote. But again, not everyone was a fan. This unique idea was the catalyst for him being ejected from the University of Michigan Medical Center after being told to drop the idea or leave the university. Jack was not deterred and continued to, in turn, moving over to Pontiac General Hospital, where he upped the ante again with even more controversial experiments. He's a restless man with a restless mind that seems to find comfort in research and new ideas. So what are these experiments? Well, he borrowed some ideas from a Russian medical team who were, wait for it, transfusing blood from corpses into living patients. His intentions were good, and the results were highly successful, and the times that it weren't, there were circumstances out of his control. He believed the procedure could potentially help to save lives on the battlefield if a blood bank was unavailable. His best friend Neil was also the subject of one of these experiments. After someone died, he transfused blood into Neil, and all went just fine. Neil was fine. I don't know why he needed the blood, but that's what friends are for, I guess. Jack's blood bank idea was featured in a 1961 Time magazine report called, quote, "Blood from the Dead," and even made its way to the Pentagon, with the hook that the blood of corpses could potentially aid injured soldiers on the battlefield in Vietnam. But, unfortunately, they were uncomfortable with this too, and his federal grant to continue the research was denied, and his colleagues considered him to be even more of an outsider. He just had way too out-of-the-box thoughts, and his crazy ways were just rubbing people the wrong way. He had radical ideas, sure, but most of them were pertaining to death, and a lot of these people were religious, and they had their own moral compass that they had to follow, which I'm sure they didn't really follow it in their personal life, but he just rubbed them the wrong way. But whether or not you loved him or hated him, he was starting to make a name for himself. During this decade, Dr. Kevorkian bounced around from various hospitals throughout the country and eventually set up his own clinic near Detroit, Michigan. This clinic failed, which set our lovable doctor on a path to California, where he landed two pathology jobs in Long Beach. These jobs also didn't stick, though. Fellow physicians, he claimed, feared his unorthodox approach and ideas. He became the enemy. The doctor kind of hit a rough patch. So in the late 1960s, the pathologist retired for a bit to film a project about Handel's Messiah, a religious-themed symphony opera kind of combo pack. But he also continued to research for his death row campaign. And he managed to find that girlfriend slash fiance during this time. The one and only instance in his life he made time for a relationship. But it didn't last long. Still on a path of searching jobless, and experiencing the trauma that would be his tipping point, his mom's cancer diagnosis. He ended the relationship. In the meantime, he turned out an impressive number of books in the academic vein. He also wrote technical books that focused on his own reflections and questions about religion and the idea of transcendence. The religious right had shirked him one too many times, and he didn't really respect their Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, doughboy fraud persona. In fact, and this is a random side note, to add to the list of Jack's quirks, he also had an odd relationship with food, I think. Sorry, when I said doughboy, it reminded me of food. So, he didn't like fats, and he would go on hunger strikes when arrested, and he just seemed to have some sort of control issue, I know that's shocking, toward his diet. And he was also notoriously frugal, only buying his clothes from the Salvation Army. And I imagine growing up in the Great Depression like my grandparents did, no matter how much money you have, you always think it's going to be taken from you. So you save, 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 and a can of beans is just fine for dinner. And Jesus, I once saw my nanny eat at least a week-old chicken, and that iron gut didn't skip a beat. I was horrified. I get really grossed out by old food, though. I know I'm doing, like, a lot of defending of Jack Kevorkian, but a lot of people didn't like him. But from my perspective, I found him heartbreakingly honest and kind. I don't know. I thought I was going to think he was some sort of, like, evil, you know, doctor. No, I think he just had a weird approach with things. But his heart was in the right place. Okay, I'm done. I'm done defending him. You get the point. Jump to 1985 now. Jack spent the early 80s living alone, sometimes sleeping in his car while living off Social Security. But in 1985, his Michigan roots drew him back home to write a comprehensive history of experiments on executed humans. This riveting report was rejected by most prestigious medical journals, but was published in a more obscure one, the Journal of the National Medical Association. And then something clicked. In 1986, Dr. Kevorkian learned that doctors in the Netherlands were helping people to die by lethal injection. This was an intriguing way to expand on his death row proposal, and he launched a new campaign. It wouldn't just be focused on medical experiments on the dying, but on the practice of euthanasia. With these new concepts in mind, new articles began to flow out of him with ease, this time focusing on the benefits of assisted suicide. He even crafted a crude suicide machine he called the Thanatron, which in Greek means instrument of death. In all, the materials involved in the construction only cost him a mere $45 and dispensed successive doses of fluids, a saline solution, a painkiller, and then a fatal dose of potassium chloride. The design even allowed for patients to administer the lethal dose of potassium chloride themselves, something that would prove to be an important point where future arrests were concerned.
What I'm getting at is, where do you make the decision, you, doctor,
yes,
at what point this person should be assisted and at what point they can have a quality of life so that you would say, I won't do this?
That's a good point. I had to make the decision alone because nobody cooperates with me. So I took it on myself for the sake of the patient.
Why don't you just tell your patients how to commit suicide?
Because they're afraid to do it alone. They're afraid to be alone. They're afraid it may misfire and they'll end up worse than before. They all tell me this.
Do you turn patients down? Will you assist anyone who says, I want to die?
I've turned down, I think, 97-98% of the patients who've contacted me.
But not every patient in pain was accepted by Jack. In fact, most weren't, or they were told to just wait a little longer and reevaluate, think it through. He didn't want people making a decision in a moment that they couldn't turn back from. The practice in the Netherlands was also operated this way. This was it. He made a decision and he wasn't going to turn back when he was contacted by his first patient, Janet Adkins. She had heard about him through her local doctor in Portland, Oregon, who knew Jack and approved of his device. It was 1990. Janet was 54 and suffering from Alzheimer's disease. A cruel blow for a person who, her husband said, was the light of their life, and she prided herself on being sharp and curious and looking at the world philosophically. And to lose that was devastating to her. In fact, prior to her diagnosis for Alzheimer's, Janet had been a member of the Hemlock Society, an organization that advocates for voluntary euthanasia for the terminally ill. Upon making contact with Jack, she and her husband and her best friend flew to Michigan to meet him in person. At their first meeting, Jack agreed to assist her, with the blessings of her beloved husband and her best friend by her side, in a restaurant over dinner. That's so crazy to me that you could be in a restaurant and have no idea the magnitude of the conversation happening beside you. So, one of the most devastating losses for Janet was the day she forgot how to play and read sheet music. This was her and her husband's nightly routine. It was one of the ways they stayed connected after all these years, and now it was just gone. She couldn't remember how to play, and was worried she was soon not even going to remember her husband. Jack deemed her alert enough to understand the conversation they were having. And then Janet signed several detailed documents, which were later confiscated by police. The documents weren't legally binding, and Jack didn't seek payment from the couple. He just wanted to help. He told the New York Times, quote, "She knew enough to know what was coming, and to know she didn't want it." This was another topic discussed when he was interviewed by Barbara Walters for 2020. She questioned him on this, and here's a clip of that.
When Janet Adkins told you that she wanted to die, that she had no desire to keep living with Alzheimer's disease, isn't it possible that she was just extremely depressed, that there could have been more months? Mm-hmm. I mean, for you alone to have made that decision, that's what so many people criticize.
Yes, I understand the criticism. It's well taken. But it's not entirely valid.
Well, even if it's a little valid, well, I mean, we're talking about death.
The point, 2,000 miles separated us. If this were legitimate, legalized, so the doctors could do it as a routine service, at least competent doctors, she could have been visited every month, then every week, then every day, until you're sure you're at the point where her mind is going. But we were separated by 2,000 miles. She had been under a new experimental drug, which didn't work, under a psychiatrist's care, and I know personally she wasn't morbidly depressed. And when I talked to her, her memory was slipping very badly, and I had to act then because there was no way I could fine-tune this 2,000 miles apart. For the sake of the patient, I did it.
When Janet and Dr. Kevorkian met one last time, Janet's husband and best friend opting to wait at a nearby hotel, it was inside his rusty 1968 Volkswagen van in a public park with electrical hookups for campers, near his home in Holly, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. It was far from the experience he wished for Janet, but he had been turned away by every other possible option. So he sought to make the best of the ambiance, installing a cot with new sheets, pillowcases, and curtains. It is here that Janet administered her own painkiller and her own poison, and died of heart failure within 5 minutes. Dr. Kevorkian maintains, according to the New York Times, that just before she died, quote, "she looked at me with grateful eyes and said, thank you, thank you, thank you." When the line to the heart monitor went flat, he disconnected the tube and called the police, telling them what he had done. He said his only regret was that Janet's organs couldn't be donated because her body remained in the van too long before being taken to the hospital. Had it not been for the delay, he told the Times, quote, "you could have sliced her liver in half and saved two babies, and her bone marrow could have been taken, her heart, two kidneys, two lungs, a pancreas. Think of all the people that could have been saved. If you were waiting for a new heart, you'd be all for what I'm doing," he said. "She had a good, strong heart. I know. I watched it on the screen." End quote. He told the New York Times in another phone interview afterward that they'll all be after me for this, but maintained that my ultimate aim is to make euthanasia a positive experience. I'm trying to knock the medical profession into accepting its responsibilities, and those responsibilities include assisting their patients with death. If it was possible, Dr. Kevorkian became even more of a media sensation after this, though. He became a hero and a villain all at once, polarizing more than pretty much any character around that time. You loved him or you hated him. Jack could have been the poster child for this quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Quote, "There's no hero without a villain. A hero is someone who has given his or her life to something bigger than oneself. A hero is no braver than an ordinary man, but he is brave 5 minutes longer. Hard times don't create heroes." But this was just the beginning of Jack's battle. The state of Michigan charged the doctor with Janet's murder, but the case was later dismissed because of the state's indecisive stance on assisted suicide and the fact that she administered the lethal drugs herself. Meanwhile, after Janet's death, her husband, Ronald Atkins, and two of the three sons held a press conference in Portland and stated that the wife and mother made the decision to die shortly after receiving her Alzheimer's diagnosis. Ronald read a portion of her suicide note hours before her death to those in attendance. Quote, "I have decided for the following reasons to take my own life," it said. "This is a decision taken in a normal state of mind and is fully considered. I have Alzheimer's disease, and I do not want to let it progress any further. I do not want to put my family or myself through the agony of this terrible disease," end quote. Kevorkian said the 54-year-old woman, quote, "had a wonderful life, a good life, but she was slipping from an incurable disease and she didn't want to suffer." In early 1991, a Michigan judge issued an injunction barring the use of Kevorkian's suicide machine. Then later in the year, the state suspended Dr. Kevorkian's medical license. But the doctor was nothing if not ambitious. Not being able to use his machine would not stop him from continuing to pursue his mission. And he had begun to get call after call from terminally ill patients in such severe pain that some had unsuccessfully attempted to end their lives several times. It's just so sad. He had to keep going. He felt morally obligated to. So after being banned from using his original device, he created one that was administered through a gas mask. And if it looks like the scene in the, I will say, unbelievably brilliantly acted Jack, played by Al Pacino in the movie You Don't Know Jack, I will say this scene was very, very hard to watch. If that's how he did it, that it is hard to watch. But the whole movie was, I was blown away by it. It was actually one of the better movies I've seen in a long time. But it's incredibly difficult to watch. I had to watch it in shifts because I would start crying and I'd be like, I think I'm going to pretend like this isn't happening now. I'm going to do a 30-minute stint and then I'm going to do something else for a little bit. But I encourage you to watch it if you are in the headspace that you think you can handle it, because it is a very good movie and it really does make you think. You feel uncomfortable and sad, but I feel like it is an important topic. Anyways, here's another revealing clip from his 2020 interview with Barbara Walters.
In a secluded state park covered this week with a mantle of snow, Kevorkian obliged the wishes of two women who wanted to end their lives. This cabin was where they died. Kevorkian said he used it because he had been turned down every place else. Marjorie Wants was 58 and suffered from an extremely painful pelvic disease. Sherry Miller was 43 and incapacitated with multiple sclerosis. This video was recorded the night before they died.
Sherry, what is it you want? Put it in plain English.
Yeah, I want to die.
That's as plain as you can put it?
Yeah. I wish we could do it, like she said. I wish we could have done it a year ago.
Yeah.
Two years ago.
Marjorie Wants used a suicide machine like the one that killed Janet Atkins. Sherry Miller's veins couldn't take a needle. She breathed from a mask containing carbon monoxide until she could breathe no more.
Doctor, after the death of the two women, Mrs. Wants and Mrs. Miller, what did you do?
I did what one has to do by law. I notified the medical examiner's office and the sheriff's department, and I informed them both that there had been a double physician-assisted suicide, and then I had to tell them where it was.
Kevorkian was charged with two counts of murder. At age 63, he faces the possibility of spending the rest of his life in prison, life without parole. When we met this week, I found him both unafraid and outspoken.
Doctor, let me be frank.
Surely.
You're aware that people think you are a ghoul?
Surely.
You're aware that people think this is a horror story?
Sure.
How do you answer it?
That's emotionalism. It's... when the heart transplants first came in, that was the same thing. People, many doctors were saying, this is wrong. It's contrary to God's will, contrary to nature. Isn't it ghoulish to rip a person's chest half open to transplant a heart or do a bypass operation?
Jack continued to maintain that he had not committed murder because the patient, not the doctor, administered the fatal medication. But the state of Michigan and the religious right were not going to back down. In 1992, the state legislature passed a bill outlawing assisted suicide, directed pretty much right at Jack Kevorkian. Jack was thrown in jail twice that year, but was bailed out by his outspoken lawyer and now friend, Jeffrey Feiger, who argued that, quote, a person may not be found guilty of criminally assisting a suicide if they administered medication with the intent to relieve pain and suffering, even if it did increase the risk of death. Jack was prosecuted four times in Michigan for his assistance in suicides and was acquitted in three cases. A mistrial was declared in the fourth. But Jack was no longer satisfied with slinking around like a bootlegger during Prohibition. He believed in what he was doing, and so did his patients, so did the loved ones of his patients. He had already been persecuted and vilified. What did he have to lose at this point? Well, I believe what he thought he had to lose was going to bed at night and regretting not making widespread change. They'd already taken so much from him, so let her rip. Or, more beautifully said, in the HBO movie, and I really hope this is exactly how this conversation between two friends went down, because they'd been through the ringer together, and I just think that, well, whatever. I'm just, in my head, I'm going to believe that the writer somehow, I don't know, contacted Jack and Neil, and this is exactly how it happened, because I just kind of fell in love with this scene. Here's a clip from the HBO movie, You Don't Know Jack, brilliantly acted by Al Pacino and John Goodman. Set sail, set sail. This scene is...
You're doing the deed yourself. This is really crossing into uncharted territory.
So I set sail. Rudderless, I admit, but that's the way it goes.
This is going to allow me to do direct lethal injection.
I'm all alone, Neil. And I'm running out of time.
That first day, 35 years ago, you came down to the basement lab, talked to all us med techs. You were the only doctor in the whole hospital we didn't think was a pompous son of a bitch.
Well, that was your first mistake.
And what happens next, and what seals the deal for Jack to finally end up in prison, was an extremely risky and hard to watch move. Again, he's not perfect, but I will say, this ALS patient who wanted to not suffer anymore, his family, his wife, his brother, defend Jack to this day. And I'm going to end this episode, after you listen to this clip, on the beautiful speech that the brother of Thomas York gave while accepting an award on Jack's behalf while Jack was spending 8.5 years in prison for what he believed in. Here's a clip.
Dr. Kevorkian, who brought us this tape, says he wants to use this case to move the public debate from doctor-assisted suicide to euthanasia, death triggered directly by a doctor. Dr. Kevorkian says that's what he did to Tom Yelk, a victim of Lou Gehrig's disease. In a few minutes, you will actually see Dr. Kevorkian end this man's life. First, though, we'll tell you why Mr. Yelk wanted Dr. Kevorkian to do it, and why the doctor wanted you to see him do it, even though it could get him charged with murder.
You killed him. I did, but it could be manslaughter, not murder. It's not necessarily murder. But it doesn't bother me what you call it. I know what it is. This could never be a crime in any society which deems itself enlightened.
Tom Yelk led an active life. He restored and raced vintage cars. But 2 years ago, at age 50, he was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, a devastating, incurable illness that destroyed his muscles. He lost the use of his legs and then his arms. His family says he was in terrible pain, had trouble breathing and swallowing, and was choking on his own saliva. So they wrote Dr. Kevorkian, who lives nearby, and he videotaped his first meeting with Tom.
Can you move your legs at all?
Yeah.
How about your left arm? Try. That's all you can do? You can't lift your hand off the thing now.
Trying to talk to Tom, you learn how bad he was. He couldn't also make intelligible words. Barely intelligible.
Barely. From the tape, you could see barely.
Right.
What is your religion?
Gasping.
Do you have any children?
No.
Okay.
And you could see him breathing, gasping, leaning back every time he tried to talk. He couldn't utter more than a few syllables at a time because of the weak muscles. And he was terrified of choking. Terrified.
Up to now, Kevorkian says he's helped people to die by having the patient flip the switch to start the lethal drugs flowing. And Tom could have done that. But Kevorkian suggested that instead he give Tom a lethal injection. He says that's more reliable and more humane, and he wants to push the public debate from doctor-assisted suicide to euthanasia.
Did Tom know that you were making, in effect, an example of him?
Yes.
He did?
Yes. And I sensed some reluctance in him. I did.
Because he thought he was getting assisted suicide.
That's right. And actually, this is better than assisted suicide. I explained that to him. It's better control. Then he did agree, which I think I didn't force him to agree. He did agree.
Maybe How do you know he agreed?
I had him signed saying that he chose direct injection, and he signed it.
The emboldened doctor on the 60 Minutes episode dared the courts to pursue him, and they did, bringing a second-degree murder charge against him. And he wanted to be convicted to resolve whether he was right or the prosecutors were right. And Thomas's family sided with his choice to end his life. Here's another clip from 60 Minutes.
Either they go or I go.
What does that mean, they or I go?
If I'm acquitted, they go. Because they know they'll never convict me. If I am convicted, I will starve to death in prison. So I will go. One of the two of us is going to go. And that's why I did this. The issue has got to be raised to the level where it is finally decided.
You were engaged in a political, medical, macabre publicity venture, right?
Probably.
And in watching these tapes, I get the feeling there's something almost ghoulish in your desire to see the deed done.
Well, it could be. I can't argue with that. Maybe it is ghoulish. I don't know. It appears that way to you. I can't criticize you for that. Mm-hmm. But the main point is the last part of your statement, that the deed be done.
Tom's family, his wife, Melody, brothers Terry and Bob, and his mother Betty all say Tom was a fighter, but that he finally decided he needed Dr. Kevorkian.
I was so grateful to know that someone would relieve him of his suffering. I don't consider it murder. I consider it humane. I consider it the way things should be.
And I take it that you would not be sitting here unless you thought it was useful, socially useful, to have this broadcast.
Absolutely. We were at the end of our rope. We didn't have any options. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for Dr. Kevorkian, I'm not sure what we would have done.
You want Tom to be, forgive me, a poster boy for euthanasia?
Oh, exactly not. Tom is very private. And also he believes it's a private issue. You should be able to do what makes sense to you. And I'm shocked that it's come to this, that in the 90s we have to make such an issue out of something that a person should be in control of their own life and death.
Dr. Kevorkian was sentenced to 10 to 25 years in prison at the age of 70 years old. He was released at the age of 79 and died shortly thereafter. He was actually able to attend a few award ceremonies where Al Pacino accepted the award for playing him. He died of hepatitis C, which he was diagnosed with early in his career. While some thought he was on his deathbed, Dr. Kevorkian rose to the occasion and with the time he had left, continued to champion euthanasia, touring on a lecture circuit throughout the country. I'm going to end on a few quotes from people who knew him. Media people, to start with, who interviewed him. Andy Rooney of 60 Minutes said, quote, "You can dislike Dr. Kevorkian for a lot of reasons, but he is not an evil person. He believes too many people are dying long, tortured deaths, and he wants it to be legal for a doctor to help them out of this world." And the man who interviewed him in his most controversial of times, Mike Wallace, said, quote, "He's a decent and compassionate man who tried to help people get out of the suffering of their lives." But most importantly, here are some quotes from the loved ones of his patients who were unwavering in their support of the man who took their favorite person away. If that doesn't tell you something, I don't know what will. Jack Kevorkian, rest in peace, you complicated, lovable innovator. I wish I could have had a drink with you. The title of the article says, "Family of Kevorkian Patient Accepts Award on Imprisoned Doctor's Behalf." Melody and Terrence York received the Foundation Citizen Activist Award for Humanitarianism during a ceremony at the Charles Hotel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In 1998, Kevorkian helped Melody York's 53-year-old husband, Thomas, take his own life by lethal injection. Melody York had this to say. "It's a very difficult thing to give up your privacy and leave yourself open to criticism and scorn. He risked his personal freedom, and today he is in a very small cell, alone but not forgotten." And Thomas's brother Terrence said this, "Every day he remains in prison is a day too long. We are honored to accept this award." In a letter written in prison and read to the crowd by his attorney, Kevorkian expressed gratitude for the award. He said, quote, "I certainly wish I could be there tonight, but in a real sense, I am. In spirit, I'm joining kindred souls in a ceremony celebrating the defense of a fundamental human liberty." Rest in peace, Jack. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'll see you next week.